LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Still feeling the burn, Hillary's troubles with millennial voters. I'm Todd Purdom, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point. Hillary Clinton still leads Donald Trump in most polls, but she's having trouble exciting a key group, the younger voters who flocked to Bernie Sanders. Why is that? Why doesn't the idea of the first female president generate more enthusiasm? Sanders' campaign forced Clinton to adopt what even he describes as the most progressive Democratic Party platform in history, but that's not good enough for some Sanders supporters who now look to third-party candidates. In a close election, millennials could tip the balance. We'll examine whether there's anything Clinton can do to change that in the weeks ahead. Later, on today's Talking Point, a look at the history and logistics of presidential debates on the eve of next week's big showdown. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. In a moment, we'll discuss Hillary Clinton's challenges in wooing younger voters and hear a debate between a couple of them. Then, on today's Talking Point, The New Yorker's Jill Lepore on the six-decade evolution of televised presidential debates. First, this news update. President Obama is set to veto a bipartisan bill that would let families of 9/11 victims sue Saudi Arabia in American courts. And Congress is poised to override that veto, the first time that's happened in the Obama presidency. We're joined now by Julie Hirschfeld Davis, a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, good to be here.
You know, in the face of the Republican Congress these last years, the Obama White House likes to say that the president's willing to use his pen and phone. He's all set to use his pen on this question. Why is this a big deal?
Well, this is the 12th time he's vetoed a bill, but as you said, this is going to be the first time, if Congress does go through with it, that they will actually override him. And it's on a piece of legislation that's obviously very emotionally sensitive. The 9/11 families have pushed very hard and for a long time for this bill, which they say they need to be able to go forward with their lawsuit in court against Saudi Arabia for any role they might have played in the plot.
Or helping the hijackers escape or other things like that, too,
Exactly. And any sort of material support that they might have provided, logistical support and that sort of thing. And the debate over the specifics of the legislation is really kind of an arcane legal one. But obviously, the broader issue is a little bit difficult to explain. So it sort of puts the president on the other side from the Congress against these families who basically just say they're looking for justice for their slain loved ones, which is a place the president never wants to be.
What's the president's main objection? What is his fear could go wrong if this bill becomes law?
Well, the White House basically says, you know, there's this longstanding principle of international law known as state sovereign immunity, and it holds that governments cannot be held liable in courts of law. And so this would make an exception to that. There are already several exceptions in the law to sovereign immunity for things like commercial issues and torts. And obviously, if a nation is found by the United States to be a state sponsor of terror, that puts them in a whole different category. But the concern that the White House voices is that other countries will then go forward and change their laws so that their citizens can sue Americans in their courts in foreign countries. And because the United States is a global nation and it has military operations and commercial operations all over the world, they say, you know, we are open to the most exposure of any country if other countries were to go forward and change their laws and in a sort of reciprocal way. So that's their main objection.
What about intelligence secrets? Is there worry that discovery in lawsuits of a case like this might force the United States to divulge sensitive information that it's gathered about foreign governments?
Well, I think that is a big of this legislation point out is, you know, there's an exception in here for acts of war. There are exceptions. Diplomats are treated differently under the Vienna Convention. But the White House argues it won't stop people from trying to bring these suits, from trying to pass these laws that allow more lawsuits to be brought. And even if a lawsuit is completely without merit, it can go through the process and result in discovery, and that can put at risk our intelligence operations and our military operations in important ways that would put the nation at risk, essentially.
Now, I understand why this is such an emotionally freighted issue, but both these bills passed both houses of Congress. This bill passed both houses of Congress on voice votes without extensive deliberations, and not in the white hot aftermath of 9/11. Let's not forget, we're 15 years on. Why now? Why is there such a groundswell about this issue, and why did it pass so easily?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it passed the Senate in May, and for years they've been debating this legislation, and they've gone back and forth, and there was some debate about it in the spring about how broad or narrow it should be. They did narrow the legislation somewhat to make sure that, you know, they weren't going to open the way for many different types of lawsuits. Essentially, it would only apply to lawsuits against a country that was found to have supported a terrorist strike in the United States that killed Americans on American soil. But really, people, I think, were blindsided by the pace and ease with which it went through the House. I mean, it had been on ice or on hold, essentially, since the Senate passed it in May. And it really didn't start to gather steam until the last few weeks, at which point it was very clear that not so much it had a groundswell of support, but no member was willing to raise his or her hand and say, wait, I object to this, because as you point out, it is so emotionally freighted. And we are, after all, only weeks from an election.
Now, when presidents get their vetoes overridden, it tends to be late in their terms. Does the Obama White House really worry that this will be any kind of significant blow to the president's prestige, or is it just something that they feel they have to fight on the merits?
I think they feel it's something they have to fight on the merits. And listen, they recognize that it's a loser for them politically, and that it looks bad, and the last place the president wants to be is, you know, in opposition to these 9/11 families, who, after 15 years, as you said, still carry a lot of weight in Washington and, you know, inspire a lot of sympathy in all of us, of course. But I do think that they're resigned to the fact that, you know, if this is going to get to his desk, this is what he's going to have to do. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton, who has previously said that she supports the bill, did make it clear today that if she were president, she would sign it, which kind of undercuts some of the arguments that the White House and, you know, national security leaders have been making this week in the run-up to the veto, saying, this would be a horrible precedent.
Where you stand depends on where you sit. That's always been true in Washington. Thanks so much to Julie Hirschfeld Davis. In a moment, Hillary Clinton's problems with younger voters on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. If Hillary Clinton wins the White House, she'd be the second oldest president ever inaugurated, after Ronald Reagan. She's been a prominent figure in American political life for 25 years. She's arguably better prepared for the presidency than anyone in history. And that's a problem for her with some younger voters. She herself knows she has work to do, as she acknowledged to students at Temple University in Philadelphia this week.
Even if you're totally opposed to Donald Trump, you may still have some questions about me. I get that. And I want to do my best to answer those questions. When it comes to public service, the service part has always been easier for me than the public part. I will never be the showman my opponent is, and you know what? That's okay with me.
Daniel Dale, the Washington correspondent for the Toronto Star, has written extensively about this issue. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you.
What is Hillary Clinton's problem in this regard? Why is she struggling to close the sale with these younger voters?
I think some of it is, as usual with her, about her personality or her perceived personality. A lot of these young people see her as inauthentic. But it's more than that. It's more than authenticity or honesty. It's that they perceive her to be too cozy with the system that they feel has let their generation down. So they've grown up in an era of political gridlock where nothing gets done in Washington, where, you know, capitalism is not always a good thing. And they see her as too close with the people who have produced this life for them that they feel isn't great. And there are other factors as well. So it's a complicated issue for her.
And this matters a lot because for the first time this year, right, millennials will be an equal share of the electorate with the baby boom generation that Secretary Clinton herself belongs to.
Yeah, it's a big generation. You know, young people don't vote as frequently and in as high a proportion as older people, but they're really important. And they were a really important part of the so-called Obama coalition that helped the president win in 2008 and 2012. So she can win without huge numbers of them, but it would really make her life more difficult.
Polls in some states seem to show that she's actually winning a bare majority of millennials, but just not by the margins that Obama racked up in 2008 and 2012, right?
Yeah, we can get carried away in talking about this. She is still the preferred choice of millennials. The problem is that she's not the preferred choice by enough of them. Obama won about 60% of young voters. She, in some of these polls, is below 35%. It's not that they like Trump. They loathe him. Her problem is that they're flocking, to some extent, to the third-party candidates that many older people are not even paying attention to. So that's Libertarian Gary Johnson and the Green Party's Jill Stein. Gary Johnson in some of these polls is right on her heels. So yeah, those third party candidates are a big challenge.
50 years ago, when John Lindsay was running for mayor of New York and bucking the system, the columnist Murray Kempton summed up his appeal by saying, "He is fresh and everyone else is tired." Is Secretary Clinton suffering the reverse of that this year in a way?
I don't know. There's, I mean, she has a connection problem with these younger people. You know, it's not only the general concerns that many voters have about her level of honesty and transparency. It's that she has a hard time relating, and when she tries to relate, she can often paradoxically come across as even more inauthentic. I think we've seen her in the last week, especially, make a concerted effort to ameliorate her image with them. She did an interview with Humans of New York, that popular Facebook page. She appeared on Between Two Ferns, the satirical, you know, interview program with Zach Galifianakis. So she's making an effort, but it's not clear if it'll work at this point.
That's Daniel Dale, the Toronto Star's correspondent in Washington. For a closer view of this situation, let's talk to someone who's been in the trenches. Jeremy White is a filmmaker, production designer, and grassroots organizer in Los Angeles. He was a Bernie Sanders backer, but just can't bring himself to support Hillary Clinton. Welcome to the program, Jeremy White.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. What is your problem with Secretary Clinton? I mean, theoretically, you're of a demographic group that she ought to be able to have some appeal to. What is not closing the sale for you?
Well, I think early on, her recalcitrance to release her transcripts for her paid speeches to Wall Street and other special interests was kind of a big letdown for a lot of people who had seen her as somewhat of a progressive, but in contrast to others running, she just kind of fell short there. And
she still hasn't done that, right? She still hasn't.
Yeah, her campaign, she has failed to release them. It's not even an issue to them anymore, apparently. But there are many people that I know, and myself included, that would really like to see those transcripts. And other things included. She has a transparency issue. Even something as simple and human as, you know, being ill was handled so poorly that it just gives rise to massive conspiracy theories because they're not being honest. They're not telling us what's going on.
Now, when she was first lady, she did fight the good fight for something like health care reform, and she took a tremendous political beating for it. So you wouldn't doubt that over the years she has, in fact, you know, advocated for causes that you would have to call progressive, right?
There have been times where her policies have been progressive and productive, but at other times, just as in stark contrast, she's had really regressive and conservative policies, like her welfare reform and the crime reform of the 90s that she championed for her husband.
And people look at that very differently now than they did 20 years ago, right? I mean, in hindsight, we've
seen... I mean, we're in 2016 now. Civil unrest and social injustices are at the forefront of our issues here. And that's important. You know, our school-to-prison pipeline and mandatory minimum sentencing, that all came from the Clinton era, and we have to remember that.
I mean, the challenge for her is when she was your age, she would have been you, presumably, right? I mean, she would have been out there pushing for change on the, she was on the Watergate committee. She was, you know, a young person working for George McGovern in Texas in 1972. She was for the progressive people and causes of her day, but it doesn't.
I think it's not productive to rail against her as an evil or, you know, horrible person. I think this is just endemic of a corrupt political finance system and too much dark and secret money in politics. It would happen to anybody. You know, it's almost impossible to resist that kind of temptation when you're sitting at the table with billionaires that want to affect change in the government.
And so you're going to be voting for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate now?
Yeah. You know, I know the arguments against voting for a third party, but my argument is, do I not have the right to vote? Do I not have the right to vote who I choose? And I know that living in California, we don't have the dire nature of being in a swing state.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm going to cast my vote, not in protest, but in favor of a candidate. And I really do support her policies.
That's Jeremy White, a filmmaker and grassroots organizer here in California, who's backed Bernie Sanders, now backing Jill Stein. I'd like to have us join now Melissa Byrne, who's a former digital media liaison for the National Sanders campaign, and she has now shifted her support to Hillary Clinton. Welcome to The Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why do you think Hillary Clinton has had trouble winning over so many of the former Sanders supporters? Why has she had trouble attracting those voters who were so excited by Senator Sanders' campaign?
I think it's misplaced to call it trouble. You're still seeing that a majority of millennials are supporting Secretary Clinton, including, and also like a majority of former Bernie supporters are supporting Secretary Clinton. I think sometimes the media likes to have conflict because that drives the narrative. I think one of the challenges they have had is really translating the core issues. I think a lot of times a traditional media calendar is about, oh, this is the issue of the day, this is the issue of the day, whereas young voters want to be able to see all the issues at once. Like, we consume media in a very different way than generations before. So they want to see every day talking about free college tuition. They want to see every day talking about, how do we end police brutality? How do we get comprehensive immigration reform? How do we get the public option or single payer when it comes to healthcare? And it's just about shifting over the communication message.
Is part of the... I'm sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, is part of the issue that she's simply been on the scene so long? If she becomes president, nobody but Richard Nixon has been a public figure in American life for as long as she has and won the White House. Do people just feel they know too much about her and they're looking for something fresh?
No, I don't think it's necessarily wanting something fresh. I mean, look at Bernie Sanders. She's been on the scene for, you know, about 30 years as well, but in a different way. I think it's really about hammering home the core issues. And I think that everybody that supported Bernie should be ecstatic about what we were able to win in terms of shifting the narrative on the issues. The fact that free college tuition is almost a boring topic at this point. It's so accepted in the mainstream.
Yeah. As we noted earlier, Hillary has been trying to show her chops with younger voters this week. She went on Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Let's listen to a brief clip from that exchange.
When you went to Donald Trump's wedding, did he write his own vows? And did Michelle Obama write Melania's?
I really couldn't see or hear very well, so I'm not quite sure what his vows were, but I'm sure they were great and huge and wonderful.
Like his bowels.
Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star, what do you make of that exchange? It's kind of awkward when she's going on to appeal to younger voters, says she can't hear or see very well.
Yeah, I think that is, as far as I understand, that is the gimmick of the show, that it's like this hyper awkward, you know, semi-satirical interview. So I think the joke is that she's being, you know, even more awkward than some people think she naturally is.
And she certainly didn't lose her cool or anything, and she had her poise throughout the whole thing. And it's excruciating to watch because it is so awkward, and he's almost like an otherworldly character.
Yeah, I think that the response has been pretty good. I mean, I saw some people say, "My gosh, you know, this is painful." But I think to her supporters, it was heartening to see her show this deadpan comedic side that doesn't often come out on the campaign trail.
I'd like to go back to Melissa Byrne, a former Sanders campaign worker and supporter who's been able to shift her support to Hillary Clinton. And I'd like her to ask any question she has for our other guest, Jeremy White, a Sanders supporter who's shifted his support to Jill Stein of the Green Party. Melissa, if you could ask Jeremy, what would you ask him?
Hey, Jeremy. I would ask you, what does it mean to support a candidate who hasn't done the actual on-the-ground work to be able to win an election? I think a big part of being able to talk about issues like free college tuition, about how do we make foreign policy more responsible, is having done the work to build up power to win it, because otherwise you're just talking to talk and not having a strategic plan to win. So what does it mean just to be able to support somebody who doesn't do the work?
Jeremy?
Great. Hi. Thank you first for your work for the Sanders campaign. We really appreciate everything you've done. My main goal is to break the two-party duopoly that we're currently in. I think that is the most glaring issue that's been brought up with our current election cycle, is that, I mean, this is really our only two choices, and both are so corporately corrupt, then we need more choices. So my goal is to get the Green Party to the level where it's getting federal funding and is actually a place where progressives can go, because, you know, my experience with this whole primary was massively disheartening with the Democratic Party. You know, we witnessed a lot of suppression, a lot of aggression from older and establishment members. So I think it's time for a change. So that's where I'm putting my efforts.
That's Jeremy White, a Sanders supporter who can't bring himself to support Hillary Clinton, and exchanging views with Melissa Byrne, a former Sanders worker and supporter who is supporting Secretary Clinton. You know, 8 years ago when Secretary Clinton was running against Barack Obama, she didn't really emphasize her status as the first serious female candidate for the presidency, and she was so intent on buttressing her credentials as a potential commander-in-chief that she let that be a secondary thing. This time around, she's emphasized it more, but it hasn't seemed to click with some younger voters. Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star, is that partly because some voters are simply too young to remember the struggles Hillary Clinton fought and won?
Yeah, I think that's the theory I've heard most often, is that, you know, the generation of women that really had to fight for their rights, and obviously women are still fighting for their rights, but the generation that, you know, that really felt the harshest discrimination is you know, pretty old now. And these younger people, you know, they've taken for granted living in the world we do now, and they, you know, they don't have a sufficient appreciation for the struggle. But, you know, what I hear more often from voters is that they do appreciate that. They do think it's a significant milestone, but they just don't think it's quite enough. You know, they're not going to vote for her just because of this potential to make history. They want policy. They want progressive policy. They want someone who they feel understands them, and they don't always feel that that's her.
Melissa Byrne, are your friends excited about the prospect of a Clinton presidency, or are they just sort of resigned to it?
I think people are excited. I think it's been really heartening for me as I talk with my friends, especially like my friends and I were some of the first people arrested against the Iraq war. We have been in the trenches for a long time, and people are really excited to have a president who's going to work for free college tuition, who's going to work for single payer, who's going to work to stop TPP. And yeah, it's nice to have a woman. I think what you're seeing with people in my age cohort is that we're not first wave feminists. And so our orientation when it comes to social justice is intersectional. And so we look for that. And so it's not the same pull. One story, I brought my mom to see Bernie Sanders at a rally in Philadelphia. And she supported Bernie because her daughter was working for Bernie Sanders. But she finally let it slip that she was really excited about Hillary Clinton, because she never thought in her lifetime that you would get a woman as president. I think for younger people, like in my age cohort and younger, we never had any doubt. Like growing up, I never had any doubt that a woman would become president.
Well, yeah, that's one of the ways in which Hillary Clinton succeeded, right? Making it seem totally plausible.
Yeah.
We'll take a brief break, and we'll be back in a minute to talk about this topic more with some more guests. Later on our talking point, we'll take a look at the history of presidential debates. This is To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. We're discussing some of the problems that Hillary Rodham Clinton is having this year in closing the sale with younger voters. We're joined now by Paul Taylor, author of The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. He's a former executive vice president of the Pew Research Center, and before that, a longtime political reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Todd. Good to be with you.
So what is the issue here? Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are, one is 70, one is about to turn 69. They'd either one of them be, Trump would be the oldest, Hillary would be the second oldest president ever inaugurated. How do we find ourselves in this rapidly changing country with these two aging baby boomers as the only choices?
Well, one of the explanations is that younger adults are pretty turned off to the political system. As they've come of age in their 20s and 30s, they've seen a Washington that's frozen in gridlock. They've seen political campaigns that bring out the worst in us. And they're coming of age at a time of great disruption in our economy, in our technology. Lots of things are changing very rapidly. Nothing seems to happen in Washington. So they've opted out of the political system to a large degree, particularly in the Democratic Party. But I think it's true of both parties. There really isn't a bench of dynamic young political leaders from the millennial generation who are coming on stream. So I think that's one aspect of it. They don't see themselves represented in a system that they think is pretty brain dead.
Mm. And, of course, it's a particular challenge with Secretary Clinton's looming candidacy. It essentially froze the whole rest of the Democratic field. Any younger people who might have wanted to get in the race were not going to do it. They were not going to challenge her because the consensus was it was her turn, right?
That's right, to some degree, and that's unusual because through most of our modern history, it's tended to be the Republican primary and nomination system that has worked kind of on the next in line formula. But I'm not sure there's a very deep bench in the Democratic Party even without that, and I think it's one of the things that's happened over the 8 years of the Obama presidency. He hasn't paid much attention to party building at the grassroots level, and I think the party is suffering from that.
Well, in fact, state houses all around the country have gone Republican on his watch, right?
Correct.
So in today's New York Times, David Brooks talks about how Hillary Clinton is surrounded by people who have been with her and her family for 20 years of their political life, are really thinking in 20th century terms for dealing with a 21st century election. He points out she still relies on old-fashioned fundraisers, big donors. She's not managed to attract the kind of small money donors that fueled Bernie Sanders' campaign. Is that also a problem for her? He said he hoped she wouldn't govern as much as a fogey as she's campaigned as.
Well, listen, she is who she is, and she's been in public life for 30 years. In my view, and the view of I think a majority of the public, whatever their difficulties with her around issues of authenticity and transparency and whatnot, in terms of her progressive values, in terms of her progressive policies, it seems to me those strike very close to the heart of what a majority of millennials want. So the frustration, which is really what this segment is about, is she is the answer for millennials on whether it's college affordability, whether it's police accountability, whether it's immigration, whether it's a whole basket of diversity and pluralism issues. She is not only talking the talk this year, but for her public life, she has walked the walk.
Yeah.
And yet there is this disconnect, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, if we go back to the long primary fight she had with Bernie Sanders, she won older adults in the Democratic nomination process by 65-70% in primary after primary, and she lost millennials by 70-75% in primary after primary. And I do think it is a lot of the things that has already touched upon in this issue. She represents a way of doing business politically that to millennials seems of another century. I think that's exactly right.
It's worth noting in this context that Hillary Clinton's not the only candidate having trouble closing the deal with some people who should be part of her natural constituency. Donald Trump is having trouble with a lot of traditional conservatives who simply can't bring themselves to vote for him. Jamie Kirchick is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative, a conservative think tank in Washington, and a columnist for the Daily Beast. He's a proud member of the Never Trump movement, but he's also voting for Hillary. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you're voting your conscience. What's wrong with voting your conscience if you're a Sanders supporter and going for a third-party candidate instead of settling for second best and going for Hillary Clinton?
Because this is an unprecedented election, and I've actually been a little disturbed by the lack of alarm that I'm hearing from your other guests. This is a candidate we have, the nominee of the Republican Party, who is a racist, authoritarian, conspiracy theorist. I'm not aware of anyone like this ever winning the nomination of a major political party in history in our country, and he needs to be stopped. And I think it's rather indulgent for people like Jeremy to say that they're going to go off and support a third-party candidate when we have this unprecedented menace to the free world, who's very close to becoming, you know, in control of our country's nuclear codes.
Jamie Kirchick, a fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington. What about that Jeremy White, a Sanders supporter who's voting for Jill Stein this fall? Jeremy, are you there?
Oh yeah, I'm here. You want to talk about unprecedented menace. We have a mainstream candidate in Hillary Clinton who sold fracking all over the world. Fracking is one of the most severe climate disasters that we face right now. It's pumping methane out in the atmosphere and, you know, increasing our heat index, which we're already dangerously close to going over. So there's that. There's the regime change all over the Middle East and in Honduras. So, you know, I see really, really horrible, ugly things in Donald Trump. I will never support him, never support his candidacy, anything he stands for. But I've seen some really terrible policy issues come up under Hillary and under Bill and the whole neoliberal, you know, dinos thing really is not something I can support.
In 2000, it seems almost beyond dispute that Ralph Nader's third-party candidacy could have cost Al Gore the presidency or could have helped cost him the presidency. I know that President Bush 41 feels very strongly that Ross Perot's candidacy in 1992 hurt him. What about that, Jeremy Kirchick? I mean, do these third-party candidates in close elections really make a difference? And if the House is on fire, do we have the luxury of deciding what sort of hose we should use?
Yeah, they actually do. And I should say I'm 32. I'm a millennial. When I was 18, I committed a youthful indiscretion, and I supported Ralph Nader for president. And I grew up, and I became wiser, and I realized, you know, the cost of these mistakes. And I would only, you know, I think there's a problem with millennials. I don't know how old Jeremy is, but I think a lot of millennials have no historical understanding. And I would just say to people of this generation who might not be familiar with history, read about Weimar Germany. Read about the Spanish Civil War. Find out what has happened in history when moral purists on the left fight other leftists or other people who are on the left for not being morally pure enough. And you know what happens? Fascists come to power. And I'm not trying to compare, you know, Trump to interwar European fascists, but he is sort of a neo-fascist. He's sort of a neo-authoritarian. And the longer this goes on, the longer that the, you know, classical liberal anti-totalitarian constituency in this country fights amongst itself and divides its vote in the same way that the German Social Democrats were attacked by the communists, or in the same way in Spain, I think you're just paving the way for a Trump presidency, and you have to be open about that.
You know, we saw this debate play out in a fascinating way this week at my employer, Politico, which ran dueling pieces, one by Adam Walensky, a former Robert Kennedy speechwriter and aide, who said he was voting for Trump because the Democrats had waged war all around the world and were now the sort of belligerent war party. And he was rebutted by Peter Edelman, another former RFK aide, who said that Robert Kennedy would hate Donald Trump. So the historical debates are very vivid.
Can I actually add something here? I think, and Jeremy said this, I think there's actually a lot of similarities on the far left, the kind of far left foreign policy view that Jeremy represents, and Donald Trump. And Donald Trump sounds a lot more to me like Noam Chomsky in the way he talks about American power in the world and wanting America to come home. He sounds like George McGovern. So I can understand why someone on the very far left of the political spectrum might actually see something to like in Donald Trump's foreign policy.
That's Jamie Kirchick, a columnist for The Daily Beast. I want to ask now Melissa Byrne, the former Sanders worker and supporter who's now backing Hillary Clinton. Was it a hard decision for you? Did you mourn for a while? Did you go through a period of Kubler-Ross stages of grief? Or were you ready with her right the night in Philadelphia when she won the nomination?
Oh, I mean, it was definitely, I mean, it's, look, like, I'm competitive. I like to win. I fought tooth and nail for Bernie Sanders to win. Because I want to make sure that free college is a real thing that happens and that we get rid of student loan debt. So, of course, I was disappointed. But one thing that we learned from Bernie Sanders is that when you fight, you win. And we knew the fight was bigger than the presidency. It's about the future of the country. And that's why we kept fighting on the issues.
When you try to persuade some of your fellow former Sanders supporters, what's the main argument you try to use?
Sure. The main argument I try to use is that I worked for a public sector union for a while out of college. And one of the lines there was that you get to elect the people that you negotiate with. And so, for example, that was a public school district in suburban Washington, D.C. And so by making sure that the right people won for executive council in Montgomery County, you could then be able to you get to pick the people you negotiate with. And for me, it's really exciting that right now we get to, when Hillary Clinton wins and we're working to pass free college and we're working to pass comprehensive student loan reform, we're going to be negotiating with people who are already, that we were already able to push and move on the issue.
That's
and that it's very practical. And I think the same will be said with foreign policy, the same for all of these issues, that we are electing a team of people that are going to go in there, and then we are going to do the work to advocate and hold them accountable.
Well,
and clearly Hillary is the one that we can move, and it's going to be exciting. And I think that it's not just going to be moving them. I think they're going to be great partners.
Because you already have moved her, right? I mean, Senator Sanders moved her in the platform.
Yeah, we won that. It was a huge win.
That's Melissa Byrne, a former Sanders supporter now working for Hillary Clinton. I want to go back to Daniel Dale, the Washington correspondent for the Toronto Star. You have a great luxury, which is covering our country for your country. So what do you and your fellow Canadians make of this election year here? And what's the sort of feedback you get from your readers about what's happening in this very strange and unpredictable time?
Yeah, well, as a reporter, it's not my place to opine, but I can tell you that, you know, the reaction I get from Canadians is basically like the question that Clinton asked out loud the other day, which is, she said, you know, why am I not ahead by 50 points? Canadians are, you know, are mystified by Trump support. A lot of what I've done over the past several months is try to explain, you know, where this phenomenon comes from. They generally see Clinton quite favorably, much more favorably than Americans do, and they see her as sort of a conventional, well-meaning liberal with flaws, but certainly, you know, no comparison to Donald Trump. And they're afraid, you know, as everyone else in the world, but you know, especially when you're right next door, everything that America does really, really affects their lives. 80% live very close to the border.
Yeah.
So people are watching, you know, they're amused and they're entertained and they're captivated, but they're also fearful for sure.
That's Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star. Paul Taylor, author and former official at the Pew Research Center, will the fact that both President Obama and Bernie Sanders have said they will campaign for Hillary Clinton, will that help her in the fall? Is that sort of support transferable, or does she have to win it on her own?
Oh, I think it might help a little bit. Those are two very popular figures among the millennial generation. Elizabeth Warren is another. Michelle Obama is another. But I would just make this point, which is what enormous power. It's been a fascinating debate between Jeremy and Melissa. Think about the power of the millennials this way. Were it not for their vote 4 years ago, the leading candidate for president this year would be the incumbent president, Mitt Romney. Romney won the election 4 years ago among all voters over 30 by about 2 million votes. He lost among millennials by 7 million votes, and leading to a fairly comfortable turnout at the end, a re-election victory for Obama. It's now 4 years later, and millennials loom even larger in the electorate. If you add up the votes, the eligible votes, now there's a turnout issue, but the eligible votes of all people in the millennial generation and the so-called Gen Xers, who are a little bit older in middle age, that's about 126 million votes. Among boomers and a group older than them, it's just 98 million. This is our future, this electorate, these millennials who are now in their 20s and early 30s, and they carry the torch of political power going forward. The turnout rates among millennials has been low. It tends to be low among younger voters. But as millennials age into middle age, it is likely to increase, because that's what happens in the life cycle. You get more connected to communities. You start to pay taxes. You have families, all and all the rest. So and we know from their political preferences that they are the most liberal generation we have seen since we've been able to track these things through exit polls and through other things. It is a very progressive generation. 44% of millennials are non-white. They celebrate the diversity and the pluralism of a country where the demography is rapidly changing. All of those themes, all of those instincts and political preferences would seem to suggest this is a very good electorate for Hillary Clinton, or frankly, for any Democrat. And yet, there is this enthusiasm gap that you've been exploring. I don't know how that all comes down. I don't know whether surrogates, even powerful ones like both Obama's and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, can deliver the vote. I think it's ultimately up to the candidate to seal the deal. And 7 weeks out, I think Hillary Clinton still has work to do.
That's Paul Taylor, one of the country's reigning experts on political demography. Jeremy White, former Sanders supporter, who still is not comfortable with Hillary Clinton, is going to be voting for the Green Party candidate. If you woke up on the morning of November 9th, now granted you live in California, which is not a swing state, but if you woke up and Donald Trump were president, what would you feel?
I would feel like the work is not done in this country at all. I already feel that way. I'm an activist. I spend every minute that I'm not making a living trying to make the country and the world a better place. So, you know, either way, any way this thing shakes down, even if Jill Stein somehow got into the White House, there's massive amounts of work to be done until racial equality and equity are a reality in this country. I take issue with the gentleman from the Daily Beast saying that my views align with Trump's. I worked really, really hard for Bernie, and I'm working really hard now for progressive Democrat and independent down ballot candidates to change the system from the bottom up, like Bernie said. So I have not abandoned the progressive cause, nor has anyone that I've been working with. Nobody's voting for Trump. Also, nobody that I worked with in the Bernie movement is voting for Hillary, honestly.
Yeah.
There's one or two that I know that are like kind of pariahs now. So
I want to get Jamie Kirchick of the Daily Beast. Quick response to that in 30 seconds. We got to move on.
Well, I mean, I just think, you know, you are on the left side, and normally you would be voting for a Democrat or someone left of center, and you're not. And there are lots of other people like you, and you're paving the way for a Trump victory. And I hate to say that, but it's something you're going to have to live with if he becomes president.
Thanks very much to all our guests, Daniel Dale, the Washington correspondent for the Toronto Star, Jeremy White, a filmmaker and grassroots organizer in Los Angeles who's backing Jill Stein, former Sanders supporter, Melissa Byrne, a former Sanders staffer who's now voting for Hillary Clinton, Jamie Kirchick, a fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington and a columnist for the Daily Beast and the Tablet, and Paul Taylor, the author of The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. That showdown is here. We'll be back in a moment with our talking point, presidential debates from Kennedy versus Nixon to Clinton versus Trump. How should the candidates argue? This is To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Todd Purdom here with today's talking point. Is Monday's presidential debate at Hofstra University really a debate at all? Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard and a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. She's written a fascinating piece about the ins and outs of modern presidential debates since 1960, and she raises some provocative questions about whether we're really getting as much out of them as we could. Jill Lepore, welcome to The Point.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this? Monday's encounter will be 56 years to the day after Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy met in Chicago and changed everything, arguably, for the future of presidential politics and the meaning of television. Have we learned anything in this time? And are we really doing as good a job as we could in letting these candidates air the issues that people care about?
Oh, we've learned a tremendous amount. It's really fun to go back and watch the debates that have been held over the years. But it's been a contentious issue all along what even to call them. When Kennedy debated Nixon in 1960, the three networks broadcast the debates live simultaneously, and they each had a panelist asking questions in the studio. But ABC News refused to call the event a debate. They called it a joint appearance because that's really what it was. And that convention has stayed with us ever since.
And the candidates themselves over time have exerted a great deal of control about the logistics, the heights of the lecterns, the size of the stools. These things all get weighed in on by the candidates, right?
Absolutely. And they have historically had a lot of clout on those matters because people have wanted the presidents, sitting presidents and their challengers to debate for a long time before Kennedy and Nixon did. FDR set a precedent beginning in 1932 of refusing to debate a challenger. He just said a sitting president shouldn't do it. This would have been on the radio, obviously. But so for a long time, presidential candidates were pressured to debate, and they refused, and certainly the incumbent refused. So when Kennedy and Nixon debated, they had a lot of control over the conditions under which they would debate because the alternative is they would just walk away. And then, if you recall, no one held a general election debate again until 1976.
Yeah.
Because people exerted that prerogative. Nixon refused to debate, for instance, even though people called him Sir Richard the Chicken-Hearted. You know, Kennedy had agreed to debate
Goldwater,
but then he was assassinated, so there was really, the precedent wasn't kept. People thought those debates would keep happening, but they didn't because people just, you know, they wouldn't agree to terms.
And Gerry Ford felt he had to because he was an accidental president, never been elected anything. He's running for election for the first time. So he did, and he got in terrible trouble with an awful gaffe about Eastern Europe, right?
Yeah, right. And Carter had nothing to lose by challenging Ford to a debate. So in 76, this was the League of Women Voters sponsored those debates, and then they managed to get people to show up every few, 4 years for a number of years. But the conditions under which they were debated were really not ideal. What the league wanted was to have the candidates do something more like formal. If you've ever been to a high school debate or a college debate, you know, kind of talk to one another, really. There wouldn't be a panel of reporters asking questions. The candidates would talk to one another. They might even, for instance, debate a proposition. For a single hour, you know, there'd be a proposition on the table, you know,
resolve the United States borders or something.
But the candidates, they wanted to hold a press conference, and they had a lot of power.
So in 1988, sorry, when George H.W. Bush was debating Michael Dukakis, this is how Dan Rather of CBS News introduced the evening.
One dictionary definition of the word debate is to discuss opposing reasons, to argue. And that is some of what will be happening here tonight. This will not be a debate in the sense of the word is often used in the English language because all of this is so tightly controlled by the candidates themselves and their managers. These things have developed over the years into what some people believe can more accurately be described as a joint campaign appearance or an orchestrated news conference.
Jill Lepore of The New Yorker, you noted that the debates were sponsored at one point in the 70s by the League of Women Voters. Now they're organized by an official commission on presidential debates. How did that entity come into being, and how has it seen its role, and has it changed at all over the years?
Well, the League of Women Voters established the tradition that the debates would actually be held every 4 years. So, you know, come hell or high water, they would get the candidates to come to terms. But the terms were not really that great for voters. And the Commission on Presidential Debates was founded by the then chair of the Republican National Committee and the then chair of the Democratic National Committee. And what they were trying to do is basically wrest control of the debates from the league and use the clout that they had as a heads of the party to really bring the campaigns to heel and insist that, all right, enough of this shenanigans with, like, you get to control who gets the stool and who gets to have, you know, the microphone at this height versus that height, and who you get to choose, who, especially choosing the moderators. The candidates insisted on having veto power over the moderators, which, you know, is just patently unfair. So that's where the Commission on Presidential Debates came in, and the league was actually frustrated at how much they thought the commission relented to the campaigns, but stepped away from the work of sponsoring the debates.
What's the belt buckle rule, and how did that apply?
The belt buckle rule had to do with trying to level the height difference between the candidates, that the podium would be equidistant, the top of the podium would be equidistant from the belt buckle of either candidate. These are only men running, right, from either candidate, so that no one would appear to have a height advantage. It's just an example of the minute level of kind of shenanigans that the campaigns were involved in, which is kind of stage detail.
And in 1988, didn't Michael Dukakis persuade them to make a little sort of pitcher's mound for him to stand on so he wouldn't look
The question of would Perot get a box? And Bill Clinton wanted Perot to, they wanted to have the debate involving Perot to be on a stool because he thought that Perot, like a high stool, because Perot would look very tiny in that regard. So there's a lot of, it's a lot of nonsense, right? Like, if you were to imagine the debate coming up next week, what if it was a resolution? The Paris Climate Accords don't go far enough, resolved, pro or con, and the two candidates would actually talk about that issue for an hour. As voters, we would get a better education about the issues. But what we're being asked to do instead is really evaluate the kind of television style and success of the candidates.
There was at least one instance in modern times when the two candidates did just go at it head-to-head. In 1992, Phil Donahue had an encounter with Jerry Brown and Bill Clinton on the eve of the New York primary, and my memory is he simply introduced them and said, gentlemen, have at it.
Yeah, it's great. You can go watch the tape online. It was on C-SPAN. Donahue apparently felt very strongly that the moderator needed to get out of the way, that a lot of television personalities had made their careers by being very active moderators during presidential debates, and he thought that was bad for voter education, civic education. So he had arranged, they'd negotiated for months over this during the primary, the night before the New York primary, Democratic primary, Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown come in, Donahue introduces them, they sit down at a table together, Donahue leans back, you know, had that leaning way,
his
chair, he leans back, and he's, have a good conversation, gentlemen. He never speaks another word. That's not on a particular issue, but those two candidates, Brown and Bill Clinton, were the kinds of guys you can imagine sitting down at a table and having a really substantive, careful, illuminating discussion for an hour. That's not the case with Not everyone who runs for president is even capable of that.
Yes, yes. And, of course, one of the big points of contention between those two guys that year was Hillary Clinton herself.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Well, it's an interesting, it's a really great read, and it's full of humor and also little-known facts. There's a lot of speculation that even this year there's been, effective veto power waged over some of the moderators. Did your reporting pick up any of that?
No, the commission's was pretty clear that they weren't going to stand for that. They have tried very hard to steer clear. We'll see. That's the kind of thing that comes out in memoirs decades down the line.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the people who can really tell the tales are the negotiators, right? People like Jim Baker and Jim Johnson for Walter Mondale who handled those delicate dances. But it doesn't seem we'll ever again face a situation. I mean, there was some speculation this year that Donald Trump might simply refuse to debate. But is the protocol now so well established that whether they're perfect or not, we'll wind up having debates?
I think anything goes at this point. He could turn up for the first debate and decide not to show up for the second and third debates. This is, of course, as everyone says, and it's a hackneyed thing to say, but this is a campaign season in which every rule of campaigning has been broken.
Were the two heads of the commission, Mike McCurry and Frank Fahrenkopf, they cooperated with you in your reporting. Did you get any little behind-the-scenes sense of, I mean, they obviously got to be sweating this one a little bit.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I talked to Mike McCurry months ago when I was first thinking about writing a piece about the debates, and it was before the nominees were known. And it was at a time when Trump still seemed pretty unlikely, actually, as the eventual GOP nominee. And McCurry was just laughing on the phone. I've just ordered the Art of the Deal. He said, I just thought I'd be prepared. I can negotiate with Trump over these things. And it was, very jocular.
Little did he know.
A couple of weeks before they were announcing the final moderators, and it was a more sober conversation.
Hang on. I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, and thanks so much to Jill Lepore of Harvard University and The New Yorker. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.